Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Market Show. I am joined today by Harriet Russell. How are you doing, Harriet?
Yeah, not bad, thanks, John.
Excellent. You've written half the magazine this week, by the looks of things.
It feels that way.
It does. And, you know, we're getting the most out of you before you leave us.
I know.
This is your valedictory podcast.
It is. I apologise to all of my loyal fans. and my not so loyal fans, but yeah, tomorrow is my last day.
Oh, it's a very sad day.
Five and a half years.
Where are you off to?
I will be heading to the business desk at the Telegraph, so people can follow me over there.
That's a well-trodden route for IC journalists, isn't
it? It is.
Anyway, good luck with
Thank you.
But we're going to try and squeeze the most out of you that we possibly can before you go. I know you're writing a large number of write-ups for our forthcoming AIM 100.
I am, yes.
Mostly across the pharma side of things, or is that retail as well you're looking
at? A couple of retailers in there, but the vast majority are actually healthcare. A lot of small drug developers on AIM, so.
Indeed. And you've got a couple of big healthcare stories that lead the news section this week that we'll discuss. One, good.
Mm-hmm.
And one, bad.
One, not so good.
Extremely bad.
Yeah.
In fact, and then we're going to talk about another quite shocking tale of woe, which is Debenhams, which looks like it's come to a stock market conclusion, to neatly wrap up your time at the Investors Chronicle.
Certainly, from a shareholder point of view, it's the end of the road, but obviously the company will continue in the immediate term.
And then to balance out that horrific retail story, we're going to talk about a good news story from retail, which is Tesco, which had results this week, which were good.
Yeah.
Where should we start? Let's start with pharmaceuticals. Let's start with good news.
Yeah, let's start with GSK.
GSK. What's going on here?
It's been a really interesting time for GSK. People who follow the stock, and I'm sure plenty of listeners do because it's very popular, will know that they are sort of trying to tread this path into eventually splitting their business in half. One half will focus much more on consumer healthcare, and the other will focus more on innovative drug development. On the drug development side of things, they have, I mean, for over a decade now, have this division called Vive Healthcare, which has been dedicated to developing HIV drugs. And this week they had a second two-drug regimen, which is basically just two drugs rolled into one, treatment approved by the US regulator, which is a really big deal, because if you can get it approved in the world's biggest healthcare market, chances are that, you know, you'll get it approved in other jurisdictions as well.
What does it do?
It's a really interesting one because it is quite specific. It's called Dovato, and it can basically treat brand new HIV patients who don't have a treatment history with the disease. Mm-hmm. And what this means compared to 20 years ago, when you were first diagnosed as an HIV positive patient, you'd be on all sorts of drugs. You'd be taking multiple drugs many times a day just to try and increase your chances of survival and a long life. Now, this two drug regimen, because they've been able to effectively combine drugs into one single tablet per day, that's all you have to do. You don't have to have a treatment history. You don't have to prove that you have reacted to certain drugs one way or other drugs another. And it's just a really, really simple treatment course for people, which means that they should have, you know, the best quality of life out there as a brand new HIV positive patient.
So it's not a cure, but it's more a sort of control type drug.
And it's just much simpler. There's a lot less aggravation, fewer side effects, because you're not taking all these drugs which will, yes, work, but possibly also react with each other and cause all sorts of side effects. This is just a much more straightforward way of treating patients, which means that they can hopefully have, you know, the best quality of life possible.
It's quite interesting. I mean, one of your best pieces of work for us that you actually won quite a major award for, a Wincott, was the Finding the Cure series.
Yeah.
And HIV does feel like one of those diseases that medicine has really had a massive impact on really, really helping patients.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are certain diseases, obviously, within the oncology space that are getting much closer to that as well. But HIV, because there are only certain forms of that disease, whereas cancer, as we're finding out, you know, there are many, many thousands of versions of that disease.
And it was cancer that kind of triggered the idea to write this Finding the Cure feature, because you often read headlines, cure for cancer discovered.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of just wanted to really put some reality on those tabloid claims that you often see. And actually work out which companies listed on the market were actually making progress. But we've looked at various diseases, HIV being one of them.
Yeah, and Alzheimer's being another. You know, all of these very sort of affecting diseases, I should say, that have were once fatal, not necessarily anymore. But how much closer are we getting to a cure? Dovato is not a cure. It also follows another drug that they had approved. That also isn't a cure either. But that one, it does apply to patients that have had a treatment history. So it's trying to find the most personalised version of medicine that has the best efficacy with the fewest side effects.
How big an opportunity is this for Glaxo then? What does this mean for their numbers?
Yeah, I mean, it's good. I mean, the idea that these drugs are blockbusters, and if people are unfamiliar with that term, it basically means that you could target up to $1 billion in sales per annum, has yet to really be tested. And there aren't really firm numbers out in the market about what this might mean, but it's going to be a big revenue earner for them. They wouldn't be pouring this much R&D into ViiV if it wasn't. I mean, if we go back, actually, one of the first big pieces I wrote for the magazine, full stop, was when there were all sorts of rumours circulating that ViiV might be floated separately to GSK because it was seen as valuable, that it could be standalone. They eventually decided to keep it within. It's kind of been the jewel in its crown, I have to say, particularly in the years that it had focused much more on consumer and it, you know, faced accusations that innovation and drug development had sort of taken a back seat. That's no longer the case, but even so, ViiV has been a constant for them, and this is proving that all of that work is coming good, and that's what, you know, healthcare investors want to see.
Indeed, and that's always the big worry for these big pharma groups, that the pipeline runs dry.
Yeah.
And GSK's kind of disproving that at the moment.
Yeah, that it runs dry and that you haven't got anything to show for all of that investment. I think profits and pharma is always a really interesting kind of discussion because it throws up all sorts of ethical kind of questions about profiteering off people's health. But, you know, I think having spoken to many chief executives, a lot of them would say that, you know, they're not running a charity. The idea is that investors are helping to pour money into the R&D pot, which helps to develop these life-changing medicines and treatments and improve patients' lives.
And so, down the road, of course, those drugs lose patents and they become generic. So the rest of the world gets the benefit at some point in the future.
At some point in the future, right. And hopefully those drugs also are enough to generate a return that investors can be rewarded for their initial upfront payments. So it's all a virtuous circle in an ideal world. Of course, things go wrong along the way, but the piece of news from GSK this week is kind of exactly what you want to see happen.
Still buyers?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, you mentioned the potential for ViiV to be spun off, or the idea that it could be spun off. That actually did happen with Reckitt Benckiser, with the other drug on the front, or the other drug company on the front page of the news section, which is Indivior. Spun out of Reckitt Benckiser probably half a decade ago, something like that.
Now. Yeah, 2014.
Yeah, half a decade ago. Mm-hmm. There you go, that was a good guess.
It was.
And their problem has been generics.
Yeah.
They've got another problem that seems to have emerged this week.
Yeah, and this is a big one. Pretty much ever since the day it was spun out, we have been bearish on Indivior. And it's because, as you say, from the day it was spun out, it just faced a whole host of generic issues. The main thing that it does is it develops treatments that are designed to try and get opioid addicts weaned. That's the simplest way to explain it. And they have this sort of flagship product, which is known as Suboxone. And shortly after they were spun out, they had developed a sort of second generation version of that product called Suboxone Film. Suboxone originally was a tablet. It was sold in bottles. And the Suboxone Film was, as it sounds, it was not sold in bottles. It was not in tablet form, although it effectively did the same thing. And they had to come up with second generation, like most drug companies, because the original one was going to lose its exclusivity rights and be subject to a lot more generic copies that were going to be cheaper, and sales were going to be eroded. And that's not an unusual story in pharmaceuticals. It's just that the sort of, I suppose, the redesign on these products wasn't particularly compelling enough to convince physicians to go for the new product as opposed to just prescribing the cheaper generic.
I was going to say that presumably there's a big price differential between the two.
Absolutely. So it's always, whenever you're developing a second gen product, you always have to think about, well, how are we going to market this to convince the physicians to prescribe the new one that's ultimately going to be more expensive than the now generic, and tell them that it's going to be that much more effective.
What was the apparent advantage of the film product over the previous delivery mechanism?
Yeah, it's a good question, because this is exactly now what the Department for Justice in the US and a court in West Virginia is disputing. So at the time, Indivior, one of the big sort of advantages that they said Suboxone Film had, and this is why I mentioned the tablet thing, is because it was a lot more sort of tamper proof. So for having it in your homes around children, they call it the pediatric safety profile. And what that means is, it was, you know, because it was sealed and wasn't in these bottles, which you could just unscrew and take the tablets, if you had children around or whatever, there was a lot less chance of an accident, basically. And this was a big thing that they sort of used in their marketing of the product to physicians. The department Indivia says that they have lots of evidence, I should say that up front, to, you know, back up these claims. The Center for Disease Control, a whole host of government agencies in the US also backed them at the time over that claim. But the Department for Justice now is saying that they're not quite sure that that was true. So what that they have indicted them on is that they basically made fraudulent claims about that product and did so through the marketing of it.
Yeah, that's a pretty horrific charge list that you lead the piece with, which I must add, Indivia are disputing.
Yes, they completely deny all allegations and they are determined to fight it in the courts. That's what we should say straight away. I spoke to a rep for the company yesterday and he seems fairly confident that they will be able to put up a good defence. So it'll be interesting to see how much evidence they are able to produce that suggests everything they did was above board and ultimately true. But, you know, in the short term, you still have to look at the facts of life, which is that this is going to be yet another costly legal case for them, and they're sort of running out of time and money to keep fighting on all of these legal fronts.
I was going to say, view, this sounds like it could be an expensive case to fight for Indivior.
Yeah, I mean, it depends how long it drags on, but they themselves said in a statement yesterday that these kinds of cases can take up to 12 months to even be heard.
And lawyers are expensive.
Yeah, and it's interesting because this case has actually been going on. The reason that Reckitt is sort of in the picture is that actually this investigation was opened in 2013, a year before Indivior was even spun out of Reckitt Benckiser. And so Reckitt Benckiser were forced to put out a statement yesterday as well, saying that they are not the ones being indicted. It is Indivia.
But their shares fell, didn't they?
They did fall. They fell about 6%. But Reckitt says that they will cooperate with authorities in any way that they need to. But ultimately, they are not the ones being charged.
I mean, they spun it out because this was a drag on the company. I remember. I used to cover Reckitt at the time, and it was as though you were, even though they were a consolidated group at the time, you know, they were essentially reporting two companies there. Indivia was almost secondary. So it ceased to be part of the Reckitt story. And I think, as I was covering it, they were trying to distance themselves from it even then. But it's quite surprising to see them still caught up in this.
It's a mess for them. Like I say, we've been bearish on the stock for a long time, but we did another big kind of bear analysis on them in mid-Feb. And unfortunately for them, but good news from our point of view, is that they're now down about 70 or 80% on that tip. So it was a sharp fall that I have to say, even I don't think I saw that coming quite as dramatically, although the outlook for the company has always been pretty shoddy.
Yeah, I must admit, I was always sceptical of their ability to fight the generic competition that was coming along. I felt it looked like a one-drug company and probably needed to do a bit more to reassure investors that there was somewhere for it to grow into.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they do have an extensive R&D operation, but they have sort of limited themselves to this one particular specialism. And who knows? I mean, maybe behind the scenes, they thought that they would be snapped up by another big pharma company if they stuck to that specialism. But I suspect the big pharmas are looking at them and thinking, we don't need any more legal cases than we've already got, thank you.
No. I mean, one thing I also perhaps underestimated when they were floated was the scale of the opioid problem in the US, which I think has really only become apparent over the last couple of years. So you would think that's a good market for Indivior.
Here's my scepticism with opioid is I don't deny it's a huge challenge in the US and it's one that's garnered a lot more publicity in the last couple of years. You're right. Not all of these patients, compare it to, say, a cancer patient, want to get better.
Mm.
This is always my thing with them. And it's a question I've regularly put to management is how do you capture the patient population when an awful lot of them are addicts and don't want or don't know how to help themselves off of that particular predicament? If you're diagnosed with cancer or you're diagnosed with HIV, you want to treat it, you want to get better, or you want to try and find a way to have a life that is as normal as possible. I'm not sure that opioid addicts necessarily fall quite into line on that front. And I always thought that that was going to be one of their biggest challenges. And even today, I think it's one of the most unspoken things when it comes to Indivia.
Mm. It's a sad story, really, all round. Except for your sell tip, which has come good, which, you know, means that you will win our sell tip of the year this year, probably, Harriet, but won't be around to collect it.
Oh, I might come back to collect it.
Sure you will. And win the quiz.
Here's hoping.
Yeah, no, your coverage of pharma I know you picked it up again recently, but it's always been excellent. We are going to miss it.
Oh, thanks.
Let's talk retail.
Okay.
Which has been your sort of second love at the Investors Chronicle.
Love, hate.
Well, yeah, it's not been a fun sexist cover in the sense that it's all been going in one direction,
yeah.
which is the wrong direction
yeah.
if you're a buyer.
Mm.
But you've had some sales here. I think you kind of gave up any hope that this was something... Actually, that's not true. There have been some good little... nuggets that you've bought that have been good.
Yeah, and there are still gems that I would say, even if the share price appreciation hasn't been as dramatic or what have you in other sectors, they're still quality companies. It isn't always reflected in the share price, at least in the last couple of years, because we've had such a rocky time since the referendum. But ultimately, my view on those companies is still pretty positive.
So. Who falls into the positive side of things?
Jules?
I've never worked out how to pronounce that.
Jules,
yeah. Right, okay.
Burberry? I still think they're a good one. Ted has obviously been through the ringer in terms of publicity in the last few months, but I think ultimately they have a business model that is more attractive.
I think that's a real shame, because actually, as a in terms of the quality of the business, the quality of the products, I think it's great, and
yeah.
I actually think that the chief executive saga probably hurt their sales. I think that must have contributed to some of their problems, some of the weakness we've seen.
They've had some weakness in Asia as well, which is a bit unfortunate. They've been exposed to that in the same way, interestingly, that luxury retailers have been.
And department stores have been exposed to department stores. That's been a real hit for a lot of retailers who were using department stores as a sort of on a concessionary basis.
Yeah, I have real skepticism when it comes to the concession model. I just think it's a really kind of like dangerous game to be playing at the moment, given the state of the high street, which probably leads us quite nicely into
Debenhams. Right, so this is, as I say, kind of game over, I would say, for the shares. Suspended?
Cancelled
now, are they? God, this is moving quickly.
No, I think FTSE Russell put out a notice yesterday about their eventual cancellation. So, yeah, it's over.
But there is a bit of a story behind it. I mean, it didn't necessarily have to go this way. And this is where, of course, the sort of... The most famous, the most hated man.
I like
retail.
To refer to him as the Donald Trump of the UK high street.
I like that. I've not heard that before. We're talking about Mike Ashley, of course. And he has obviously sunk a lot of money into Debenhams. He saw something in it that perhaps other people struggled to see.
Yeah, or other people were just wise enough not to go anywhere near. I don't know.
What was he thinking?
I still don't know, John. I don't know. Trying to get inside Mike Ashley's head is an interesting game to play. But yes, the number that's floating about in the ether is that he spent around £150 million building up a near 30% stake in Debenhams. So he has been particularly proactive in the attempt to save it from administration, which unfortunately is what it entered this week.
But this is what I'm struggling to understand. So he offered a lot of money. So he'd obviously pumped all this money into the shares already.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was offering more money.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a price to be paid for that.
And
this seems to be where the potential deal fell down.
Yeah. He offered several forms of money, several different ways. First he was going to take over the Danish side of the business in a sort of like semi-acquisition and
that was Magasin du Nord?
Yeah, that was very odd. It was not going to be enough. He then offered to basically underwrite two different rights issues for them, one for 150 mil, one for 200 mil. He basically offered to give them a loan over Christmas, an emergency loan. They went through their own refinancing, which he said he wanted to be a part of. I mean, several different things have happened. He actually even said that he was considering, it was never a firm offer, but a potential takeover offer of 5p a share, which I know sounds like nothing. But when we last were looking at them prior to the suspension of the shares, they were actually at like 3p. So it would have actually been a premium.
Quite a chunky premium.
Yeah. And each time what remains of the Debenhams board, because of course he ousted the chief executive and the chairman in a coup last year, so what remains of the board and its lenders, because they obviously were having a much bigger voice at this point, kept saying no to his various offers of help, because every single time he said, I will give you this, I will give you that, as long as you make me chief executive, as long as you make me chief executive. And this was the constant request on his part. I couldn't really understand, as much as, he might not be a likable character or whatever.
He might be a lovely character.
Who knows? Who knows? That wasn't really the point. I couldn't understand why they were so resistant to have him as chief executive. Was it something about tight control of the shares. They didn't want their chief executive in so much control.
You did mention a theory to me, though. Theory, or has this been confirmed, that there was some kind of structure to what he was proposing that could have implications for, well, I guess the lenders more than anything.
Yeah. So it's confirmed. The spokesperson for the company did confirm this to me over the phone. They said that each of these arrangements where various loans or, you know, rights issues were being offered and he was to be chief executive had come with, I want to read this out because I don't want to get this wrong, a material adverse information clause, which basically meant that they could appoint him as chief executive and sort of be on the theoretical road to recovery. But if he then went in and did his own due diligence and decided that the situation was worse than he had initially thought, he could walk away from that business, the employees, the pension, the shareholders, the lenders, with zero obligations, zero commitments. And at that point, they would have been forced to enter what's known as a disorderly insolvency. What they went into this week was actually a pre-pack administration.
So that means they can keep running the business and the lenders essentially still have something to show for it.
Yeah, the lenders own it. They bought it straight out of the pre-pack from FTI, who were the administrators. It means that all the employees still keep their jobs, the pensions are still running, the underlying companies are still running, the suppliers don't get hurt in the same way that we saw at House of Fraser. So everything is going okay, and they can now, the lenders have said they intend to sell it to whoever wants to buy it, and then whoever buys it can obviously continue with the restructuring, a lot of which they have discussed and the details aren't that different.
Indeed. So, I mean, actually, it kind of sounds sensible and you understand why perhaps Mike Ashley's overtures were rejected.
Yeah.
This is a big company. It has a presence on lots of high streets. It's still a popular shop.
And it employs 25,000 people. I think what the, you know, Mike Ashley has since come out with some various inflammatory remarks about how it all ended, because, you know, it is a game of two halves. They have, as a board and with their lenders, they have decided to prioritise people's jobs and pension and their suppliers and kick their shareholders to the curb in the meantime, because the shareholders are going to get zero equity value out of this.
I guess there is a valuable lesson there for any equity investor to understand, which is that debts comes first.
Yeah, absolutely.
Debts comes first.
Yeah.
Their interests will be served before the shareholders.
Yeah.
There you go. So, it's a tale of woe. Obviously, 100% wipeout on your Celtip.
On my Celtip, yeah.
What's that, year old, maybe?
It was last June. Algie and I had quite an interesting conversation, because I remember going into the meeting to pitch it, and it was 16.5p. which was already a huge dramatic fall from where it had been. And I remember saying to him, you know, I've had it on a mini sell for ages. We should definitely kick it up into a full sell. But are we doing that thing of, like, the horse is already bolted? And I can just remember him looking at me and saying, no, because it will go bust.
And I
agreed with him.
He was right. And he's a shrowd chap, Algie. I guess the other lesson to learn is that, I mean, when Debenhams came to market, there was a bit of people turned their noses up at the amount of debt it had been left saddled with by its previous private equity owners.
Yeah.
A warning to be careful of that kind of business.
Yeah, it's something we've looked at, obviously, in the magazine in various features before about, you know, how many times private equity have effectively screwed over, if you want, for, you know, a less kind of like attractive term, eventual shareholders in companies that they float or whatever. So, yeah, I mean, this is another example of that, I suppose, which is that the question is, did they float a company that didn't have much of a chance?
Yeah, I guess when they floated, the online trend hadn't taken hold quite as much as it has now.
No, and to give the private equity owners their due, they had spent a lot of the time that Debenhams was off the market trying to rebuild up its distribution and its logistics and try and almost mimic Next model a bit in terms of, obviously, Next having their directory business, and then try and float it, I'm sure, with, you know, hopefully the best of intentions, who knows.
They might have floated it a bit early, because that was never quite as firing on all cylinders as Next's directory business has been over the years. I guess the other thing that really caused them problems was the level of lease liabilities that they had. So they've got these great big shops, how many shops do they have in the end?
166 they have currently. Yeah. They plan to close 50 of those.
But a lot of the shops they had were on very long leases.
Yeah.
So they're essentially stuck in shops that weren't covering, you know, paying for themselves.
No, absolutely. It's a big feature you probably remember we wrote last year. I think it's called Retail's Property Gamble, if anyone wants to look it up on the website. I suppose it was prompted by the introduction of IFRS 16, just gone in January. And we were trying to get ahead of that curve a little bit and look at obviously bringing lease liabilities onto the balance sheet. And a really interesting way to look at that was to look at operating leases amongst the retailers and see kind of, it's a very interesting thing. It really does split it down the line in terms of legacy and new. So someone like Debenhams, for instance, we put into contrast with Jewels. And Jewels really doesn't have leases sort of beyond 5, maybe the odd 10-year, but nothing really beyond that at all.
Yeah, the one that's always stood out for me in terms of really managing its lease profile well is a company that I don't really shop in very much. And I look at it with amazement that this is so successful. What am I going to say, Harriet?
If I get it wrong now, that's going to be super embarrassing.
Go on.
Shoezone?
That's the one.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's exactly how they operate.
But they don't have leases beyond 5 years. Yeah.
And it's working for them.
Yeah.
That is flexibility then. I guess as an investor in the retail sector, flexibility is what we should be looking for.
Yeah, absolutely. You need to be nimble. You need to be able to get out of these leases as soon as possible if they're underperforming, if the stores are underperforming. And it frees up money. You know, you can also renegotiate quicker. It just gives you more control of your estate and it leaves you more money to then do exactly what Shoezone has done, which is invest in the format of those stores and try and make them appealing, make them interesting. You know, if you go into a Debenhams, it's a pretty sad experience. You can tell how woefully underinvested they have been, I would say over the last 10 years probably, if not more. And you know, you compare it to someone like Shoezone, I know what you're saying, you sort of look at it and you think the product itself is not, it's not desirable, it's not aspirational in the way that Ted Baker or
and the shops, I mean certainly the one near me, it doesn't look that nice.
No, but
having bought one item from there, which was a pair of male sandals.
Oh,
beach
God.
Sandals. I know.
Here we go.
They're all right.
As long as you didn't wear them with socks.
Oh, of course I wear them with socks.
Oh, my God.
I'm a middle-aged man, Harriet.
Oh, no. Moving swiftly along. if it's not a big box, though, I mean, this has been Shoezone's big strategy, is to move over to what they call big box retailing, which is much more to do with retail parks as opposed to sort of odd high street locations. And they have really invested in those stores. The one that Megan and I went to, you can listen to that online as well. We did a podcast live on site with the Shoezone management team, and they showed us around a big box site. And both Megan and I were pretty impressed, actually. It was a fairly attractive experience. So, you know, it's an interesting approach, considering that they are sort of lower down the food chain in terms of their product.
Yeah, no, it's a fascinating. I guess the interesting thing to take from Debenhams now that it's ended up where it's ended up is these kind of lessons. Yeah, there's plenty more with the magazine that you've observed over the years.
Mm.
Let's talk about another major retailer that found itself in the wars a few years ago. And it's now looking good.
Yeah.
Tesco. I like Tesco.
I was going to say, where to start?
Let's start as a customer.
Okay.
This business has really changed, I would say, in the shopping experience, which I think is one of the most important things.
Mm-hmm.
Since its troubles, you know, maybe what, sort of 3 or 4 years ago? Maybe
2014, maybe 14, accounting scandal.
That long ago.
Yes, I know.
Crikey.
We're all getting so old.
And at the time, you know, I remember Sainsbury's being a much nicer experience. Mm-hmm. I think they've reversed.
I do too. I agree. Tesco, I think, obviously Dave Lewis came in after the accounting scandal and took the reins, and they laid out these targets, a lot of which hinged around sort of operating margins and where they wanted them to be by FY 2020. Well, they've, you know, in the second half of last year, so the target is for them to be between 3.5 and 4%.
Which sounds very meagre,
yeah,
but this is food retail.
It's food retail. What can you do? We're not in Burberry right now.
No.
yeah, it's a food retailer. It's admirable, and it would have been, you know, it does mark a serious improvement. So if you look at the second half of last year, these are annual results, but they did break them down into two halves, so you could see an acceleration. In the second half, the operating margin was at 3.96. So they've already gone through the bottom end of that range.
What's driving that? What are they doing that's bringing their strategy to life?
A whole host of things. What's very interesting is pricing, because they have actually got more competitive on pricing, which normally damages your margin.
Not if you've got the volume.
Exactly. So what it's actually done is improve volume. Now, volume to me isn't just a question of pricing. You also have to do other things around that. You have to make the shopping experience more enjoyable. You have to make the stores look nice. You have to expand the product ranges. You have to appeal to more people, all of which they've done. At the same time, they've also been driving down costs. They've had massive targets around that, massive synergies. And of course, topping it all off is
Booker.
One of my
favourite... I shouldn't use that word.
No, you shouldn't.
You should not have favourites.
Critical journalist, come
investing.
On.
Well, it's just a good company. I always admired it. Yeah, maybe that's the better way to put it.
Yeah, and I do start the third paragraph with, Booker.
Quite right. Quite right. This deal was met with some scepticism when it was announced.
Yeah.
There were, of course, worries that it wouldn't get through the Competition and Markets Authority, which it did, largely unscathed, unlike Sainsbury's overtures on Asda. What has this done for the business? What has this done for Tesco as a whole?
What it's really done is drive the top line. Booker's biggest sort of plus or advantage is that it's always had very consistent sales growth, particularly on a like-for-like basis, and they've always had fairly robust margins as well, both of which feed quite nicely into Tesco's long-term targets. I do quite a sort of hefty breakdown of quite what's gone into the sales, because you will see that a big chunk of it is down to Booker. I think you've got something like 15% overall, and 11.5% of it comes from Booker. So, you know, it has a huge role to play, I would say, in this overall kind of like road to recovery.
Yeah, and it obviously brought new markets for Tesco.
Absolutely.
In wholesaling, essentially, to small retailers and food service companies.
Yeah, I mean, it basically turned Tesco into an A to B supply chain, because they can now, as you say, supply as many of itself and its other customers. And I mean, the reason that people thought it might not get through the CMA, of course, is because they worried about how much control the entire company might exert on the rest of the sector.
They were quite worried about the convenience format as well.
Yeah. Well, obviously, Tesco Express is a big convenience estate for Tesco. And then Booker owns Budgens and Londis. So there is quite a lot of crossover in that. And people did think that disposals would be a prerequisite of that deal going through.
But there were a few, not Huge numbers.
Wasn't material.
Is Booker growing under Tesco's ownership? Do we know that?
Yeah, it is growing. It's interesting as well, because obviously at the time, I think you and I both agreed that another big advantage of this deal was that Tesco was going to get Charles Wilson onto its board.
He's been unwell, hasn't he?
Yeah, sadly it didn't happen. He hasn't been well, so he's had to step back entirely, and that shook the market, actually. It's interesting, sometimes these management changes can have very little effect, and sometimes they have a big effect on the shares, and in this case it did. And the shares were rocked a little bit by that. But seemingly everything is going well. Dave Lewis is a good manager. We shouldn't take that away from him. He's obviously ex-Unilever as well, so he does come from this big sort of consumer background, so he knows the industry.
Big supplier to Tesco.
Absolutely. People will remember as well, after the referendum and the sort of sterling crisis, he really put the mockers on Unilever not to get crazy with their prices as well. Marmite Gate, I think, was the...
Oh, yes, indeed.
Was the scandal.
I dashed out and bought some alternative, and it was disgusting. I carried on buying Marmite.
There's no Bovril in this house.
I guess the question for shareholders... always, I mean, we have the shares on a buy,
mm-hmm.
because the question is always, what does the future have in store? The grocery market is still tough.
Yeah.
There are still quite aggressive competitors out there in the form of Lidl and Aldi in particular, who and I've admitted this many times, I love a Lidl.
I love a Lidl.
But they seem to be rising to this challenge.
They are. They've launched Jax, which is their version of a discount retailer. Have you been into one?
I've seen the pictures.
It's
no Lidl.
No, there are only a few pilot sort of stores in operation. They aren't nationwide yet. But, you know, I reserve judgment until they've been rolled out more heavily. They weren't really massively discussed in these results. I don't think they have much of an impact yet. But it's interesting at least to see from a strategic point of view them going after that market.
Sainsbury's tried that as well. It didn't really work. Netto,
Did
a JV? I can't remember what it was.
I'm going to say JV.
I think it was a JV.
Yeah. Sorry, listeners, we'll check on that.
But it was very short-lived, whatever it was.
But Sainsbury's, I always feel, spreads itself a bit too thin and tries to be one thing to everyone. You know, if you look at its like taste the different ranges and stuff, it's trying to target that premium customer. And then with Netto, it's trying to go the other way. I feel like Tesco, at least, it sort of knows what it does well, and then it tries to expand into that lower sort of demographic, which obviously is proving massively popular. So we'll see how that turns out. So that's one thing. But of course, the grocery sector will be massively shaped by what happens with Sainsbury's and Asda, because that will fundamentally change the market share dynamics of that entire sector. So that will be the big sort of catalyst for the sector in the next year or so. But
any more clarity on what's happening there?
No, other than to say it's in phase two investigation now, and basically it doesn't look very likely is what I'm going to say. There are already, the CMA has outlined a number of issues it has with it, obviously to do with diminishing competition. There's far too much overlap in the estate, basically. But we always said that when we've discussed it on this podcast and in the magazine, we've always said it's much more of a kind of flat horizontal deal than Tesco Booker ever was.
Just feels very defensive to me.
Yeah. It's a scale deal, and I always feel like the regulator has problems with those sorts of mergers. So
indeed. You didn't write it this week. Should we talk very briefly about ASOS? Mm-hmm. Have I pronounced it correctly?
Yeah.
Hey, my kids always tell me off of saying ASOS.
Yeah, it's ASOS.
Thanks. You didn't write it. Tom Dines picked it up this week. Tom's going to be taking over the retail beat.
He is.
In the future.
And he's doing WH Smith today. So, the transition is happening.
Yeah. On the face of it, these results look horrible, but the shares rose. I don't get that. What happened?
They held guidance.
Right.
That's pretty much it.
Isn't that like one of those, oh, the first half was terrible, but the second half's going to be great type guidances?
When I was helping Tom with it yesterday, I said to him, the big thing about retailers is that with certain ones that have been through the ringer, which ASOS has over the last year, if they don't have a profit warning, the shares will go up because the market is relief rally. That's all it is. And it did happen yesterday at ASOS. As you say, they've had this absolute horror show in the US where they have this new Atlanta based sort of warehouse which is taking over a lot of the distribution. They basically completely understaffed it so that when it launched they couldn't serve the customers, so this huge backlog of orders that's not going to come through till H2, so these are only interims, so we have yet to see the full damage of that. But management did hold their guidance. It's like, well, if they thought that it was going to have a hugely detrimental effect in the second half, they would have had to adjust that guidance. And
what have they just done? Hired a load of people then?
Yeah, basically. which will drive their costs up nicely. So I wait and see what kind of happens with that one. I think it might be a bit of a horror show. And this is a punt. I mean, I have very little sort of evidence to suggest this, but I wouldn't be surprised if we didn't have another profit warning before the end of the year.
Well, that seems like a good note to sign off on. Your final prediction on the podcast, ASOS profit warning.
Yeah.
Before the second half.
Well, before the end of the
year. Before the end of the year.
Yeah.
I must admit, I don't like it when I see companies having a bad half and then saying it's all fine, we'll make it up in a second. Well,
yeah,
half.
Exactly. You're kind of setting yourself up for failure a lot of the time. And ASOS has a lot to lose. You know, at the end of the day, the shares are so expensive and so vulnerable to any kind of bad news. So.
Not as expensive as they were.
Well, no, but
on a PE ratio basis, they are, because the profits have fallen so much.
Of course,
but in terms of the overall market capitalisation.
Yeah, there is
not
that.
Not as expensive as they were.
But if you would like to pay 70 times forward earnings, be my guest.
No, I think I'll give that a miss.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much, Harriet. Thank you for all of your efforts at the Investors Chronicle over the last, how long is it? 5 years?
5.5 years.
5.5 years.
I know.
My goodness. Where has the time gone?
I know.
Hang on, what's going on here?
It's NSYNC. Bye, bye, bye.
Oh, wow. I think that's a first. Thanks, Tom.
Thanks, Tom.
Anyway, thank you, Harriet. And let me just talk you through what else we've done in this week's magazine. The cover feature, which you've also contributed to with your farmer hat on, mm-hmm. is the Income Majors USA. We're looking at some of the biggest dividend-paying shares in America. Not a market known for income, but actually there's some fantastically large payers out there, including AbbVie, you covered, which has, as we all remember, Shire tried to get their hands on, or was it the other way around?
Other way around.
Of course it was.
Yeah, but it was blocked.
Yes. Tax inversion deal, wasn't it?
Yeah, good times.
Those were the days. So that's all changed with Trump and his kind of new tax regime. So anyway, very interesting feature there. It's slightly delayed, John Barron column this week, along with John Rosier, our diarist. Your last sector focus as the sector's editor, written by Alex Newman on Palladium. Flurry of results. Going to start to quiet down now.
Yeah, thank God.
Yeah, well, you're not here to worry about it. So, in fact, we move next week as well. You're missing that too.
Yeah, we're packing our boxes.
We are packing today. Off to St. Paul's next week in our new home. Lots of good stuff in the personal finance and funds section. Taha is looking in particular at the what he calls the older manager problem. Great funds, but with experienced heads. The experienced heads that you need, but there's always the risk that they retire. Lots of news, apart from, in fact, we went through most of it, but Alex Newman's looking at oil and the trajectory of the oil price, which is a constant guessing game. Anyway, there you go. Pick up the magazine, All Good News Agents, Income Majors USA, the prospect for America's top dividend shares. And just to say one more time, thanks for all your work, Harriet, and we're going to miss you.
Yeah, thanks, John.
And thank you all for listening. We'll be back again, hopefully next week, assuming we don't have any sort of new home technical issues. See you later.